Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. Today's guest is Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review. What we're going to be discussing is you recently got back from Iran. I recently interviewed Marilyn Miller, who's running for president, and he was with you on that same trip.
Yeah, that's right, Robert. Yes, thank you for having me on. That's correct. We were both invited in the context of something called the New Horizon International Independent Filmmakers Festival. I was invited in the context of a conference associated with that, and both Merlin Miller and I and some other Americans, and of course quite a few people from many other countries, were all involved in this conference and film festival.
So we can kind of get started off about how you first went over there. What was the security like? Well, you had to go for the security on both the U.S. side and the Iranian side.
Well, from the U.S. side, there was really nothing. I mean, I took a flight from Los Angeles to Istanbul, and there's no restriction on Americans leaving the country to go to Turkey or, I guess, any other country particularly. And then from Istanbul, I took a flight from to Tehran. The restriction, if anything, I mean, the difficulty is really on the Iranian side. It was necessary to get a visa. The U.S. government now requires that Iranians coming to the United States are fingerprinted, so Iran has introduced the same measure for Americans, so Americans are fingerprinted when they go over there. People should realize that many people go back and forth all the time between Iran and the United States. There are many American citizens who are from Iran and have family there, and they go back and forth. And in fact, there are many people with both Iranian and U.S. citizenship. So there's actually quite a lot of traffic going back and forth. And of course, there's many people going to Iran all the time from other countries. And I was, pleasantly surprised that when I did come back in the United States, I wasn't asked any more probing or serious questions than I would have been asked on customs if I had come to the United States from Europe or from any other country for that matter.
So when you first arrived there, what were some of your first impressions of the country?
Well, I had read a lot about Iran before. I had been interested in the country for a long time. I had seen a number of videos about it. So many things were not surprising. But I think for most Americans, there's a lot of things that are surprising, I suppose. First of all, you can see, just sort of normal life, and that there's a lot of just ordinary people going about their business. Now, Iran is different, of course, than the United States in many ways. Women have to have their head covered. They have to have a scarf or something covering their hair. Alcohol is not permitted in the country. There are a number of religious restrictions like that in the country, and that's very noticeable. I suppose the biggest thing that right off the bat that people and many others comment on is the wild traffic in Tehran. During the time I was there, I was really only in Tehran, which is the capital. It's a city of 10 million plus people. It has at least 10 million. Some people say 12 or 14 or 16 million. But it's a large, sprawling city packed with traffic. And there's and it's sort of amazing to see the way in which the people rush around the city, defying traffic lights, and how many pedestrians brave the traffic to cross streets and so forth. But Tehran has a lot of major buildings. There's an enormous tower that overlooks the city. The city itself is really divided into a richer northern part of the city and a poorer southern part. Most of the commercial life and so forth is in the center of the city, but it's not as well organized as a European city, but it's better organized than many places in the United States, not as some. Of course, the United States varies a great deal. But one of the things that's very noticeable about Iran, and almost everybody mentions this who visits there, including some prominent travel guides, is just how friendly and curious the people are. Rick Steves is a very popular American travel guide and travel host, and he did an hour-long broadcast about Iran, and he made the point that of all the countries he's visited, Iranians are more friendly and more eager and willing to talk and converse and so forth with people than any country he'd been to. Now, I don't know if that's my experience, but people are extraordinarily hospitable and friendly. Of course, I was in Iran as a guest, and so I was in kind of an official setting for most of the time, but not all of it. Some of the time I got away and I just talked with ordinary people and got out on my own. And that's the and my experience in that way is the same experience as many other people have, just how friendly, affable many of the people are. There's a lot of other things, too, about Iran that are different than the United States. The population is young. More than half the population is under 30. So that's a more youthful population. That's a noticeable thing. In fact, most of the population now in Iran has been born since the revolution, that is the overthrow of the Shah in 1978-79. And so they don't have any memory of a living in a society other than the Islamic Republic, which is now the, of course, the regime and the form of government that they've had in place since 1979. Another, interesting thing about Iran too, and many people are very curious about this in America, is the role of women in society. The American media gives the impression that because women have to cover their head and so forth, they're sort of oppressed, or there's an oppressive atmosphere. I found the women in Iran to be extraordinarily feminine and also very, many of them very capable, very smart. I was impressed with many of the women. In fact, if anything, the women are at least as impressive, but not more impressive than many of the men. I met very, very well-educated people. In fact, 60% of the students in Iran universities are women. So they're very well educated. At least as well educated as men are, especially younger people. Anyway, those are some of the impressions right off that were major impressions about people in Iran.
And did people talk openly about what their views on the regime was? One thing that you've said is that the strongest support is among the underclass for the regime.
Yes, people are very free in expressing their opinions, I found, about things they don't like about the regime. There's a lot of mumbling and grumbling about many of the restrictions. Now, in talking to a lot of people, and this is also borne by things I've read as well, the largest amount of feeling against the government is probably in the richer parts of Tehran. The wealthier people, the more, you might say, secular, cosmopolitan population, they are more unhappy with the Islamic Republic than most people. They would like a more European style, a more Western style society. The base of support for the Islamic Republic is especially among people in smaller towns in the countryside, and the poorer population for whom religious sensibilities are much stronger than they are among the richer and more cosmopolitan people of the country.
There's mainly cultural reasons and religious reasons. Are there also economic factors in why the regime is less popular among the rich?
Well, yes. I mean, well, I don't know how to put it exactly, but richer people tend to be more Western. They travel more. They would like a society in which more power, I suppose, also is in their hands. Because ultimately, power in Iran is in the hands of the religious clerics. The most powerful person in Iran is not the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. It's the supreme leader. His name is Khamenei, and he holds really far greater power over the military and the media and so forth than does the president, who is elected. He has less power, and the wealthier class would like power, I think, and to be more in their hands. Also, Iran has a large, in fact, most people would admit too large of the economy is in state hands, and they've been taking measures in recent years to privatize some of that. But a very high percentage of the economy is in state hands, in government hands. not only directly, but also indirectly through a number of very large religious foundations that also own a lot of businesses, control a good part of the economy. Having said that, there is a lot of free enterprise, of course, in Iran. I mean, there are banks and businesses and stores and so forth privately owned all over Tehran and all over the country, for that matter.
Did you notice any of the effects of the sanctions?
Not directly. People talk about it, and the effect of it has been, in recent months, especially during the past year or two, has expressed itself in a great increase in prices. There's been quite a lot of inflation, and the value of the currency, the rial, has fallen quite a lot vis-a-vis the dollar or the euro in the last several months. In fact, just today's news was saying that the rial has fallen to a really market all-time low. It's fallen quite a bit. So the sanctions do have an impact. They do have a harmful impact. But it's also, people told me, has made Iran more self-reliant. For example, Peugeot automobiles are assembled and have been for many years assembled in Iran. And as part of the sanctions, the Peugeot company in France no longer exports engines to Iran. But what that does is make Iran then rely more on manufacturing engines in their own country. Now, having said that, the sanctions are only partly effective because Iran does continue trade with India, China, many other countries, of course, Japan and so forth. So it's able to get things, but they're more expensive and it's more difficult in that way.
And among the people you talk to, what are some of the attitudes towards Americans in America that they expressed?
Not just my experience, but everybody that I've read who's gone to Iran also makes the same point that Iranians are, if anything, very, very, very friendly toward Americans. In fact, I think that some of the unhappiness with the regime manifests itself in a kind of exaggerated admiration or love or friendliness to the United States. I mean, Iranians, like Americans, in fact, it's an irony that Americans and America is probably better thought of in Iran than it is in countries that are supposedly friends of the United States, such as Pakistan. Pakistan is supposed to be an ally of the United States, but popular feeling, from what I read, is much more anti-American in Pakistan than it is in Iran. Now, having said that, people do understand and accept that the policies of the United States are really, have been anti-Iranian for a long time. I mean, and I've made this point over, as anybody who knows anything about the history knows, the U.S. CIA, along with the British, overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953. And imposed the Shah, who had fled the country. And he stayed in power, of course, until 1979. And the U.S. has done other things, too, that we as Americans or any other country would find really intolerable. But having said that, I think overwhelmingly, from what I could tell and from what I've read, almost all Iranians would like relations with the United States to be at least normalized or as good as possible, because there is a lot of goodwill towards Americans and to a lesser extent toward the United States in Iran, I think.
What is the status of religious minorities?
That's a very important question. The American media, or much of the American media and American politicians, give the impression that Iran oppresses minorities or Christians or Jews, and that it's, in fact, the media often gives the impression that President Ahmadinejad wants to kill Jews or destroy them. In fact, there are 20 or 30,000 Jews who live in Iran. Iran has the largest Jewish population in the Middle East outside of Israel itself. And on average, Jews in Iran live better. Their standard of living is better than that of most Iranians. Now, having said that, the country is a theocracy. Higher positions are open really only to Shia Muslims, and Christians and Jews in the country are protected, and they're allowed to go about their business. They can prosper and their religious life is protected, in fact, but they do not have position in higher administration or in the media. The media is very much Islamic, very much Muslim, and of course the military high positions in the government are held. Now, having said that, though, there is a seat in the parliament reserved for a Jewish member and a Christian, and a seat reserved for a Zoroastrian. That's the religion of Iranians before the country was a Muslim country. And there's a small minority of people in Iran who are still followers of the pre-Islamic religion of the country.
I have heard that the Baha'is they're more persecuted because their religion came long after Islam.
Right. The Baha'i religion, in effect, says that Muhammad is not the final prophet. And they are, from what I read, persecuted because that religion came after, was formed after Islam. So, and they're not protected in the same way that Christians and Jews are. But I didn't really talk about that or learn anything really new about that myself during my experience. So anything I would have to say on that subject would be just as knowledgeable as that, just as informed as that of anybody else who's read about this in the media and can read about it. But that didn't really come up in my own discussions of what I saw when I was there.
How advanced was the country? I mean, you've traveled to a lot of places and you've been to third world countries. I think a lot of Americans have the perception that Iran's a third world country when I've heard some people say it's actually fairly advanced.
Well, it's on average, I would say it's more prosperous or more organized or orderly, I would say, than certainly than Mexico, in large parts of the United States. But it's still poor by American standards or by European standards, and of course there's much more poverty, or people are of course less prosperous outside of Tehran. In the countryside and so forth, from everything I understand, than they are in Tehran.
So you were telling an interesting story about that film festival. You met a couple other people from America. One of them was a black guy, and the other was a Jewish guy. And you sort of their views of America were very different than yours. And that story I found to be very interesting.
Well, it wasn't really the views are so different. Yeah, the views are different. My point was that of the, I guess, four Americans that I spent some time with who had been invited, it was striking to me that, well, Marilyn Miller represents himself and says, I'm a representative of what he calls Middle America. And a Jewish man who was there from Los Angeles, he explained to me that his identity is Jewish. That's how he looks at himself, and he said his son. And Daryl Summers, a black anti-war activist who was born and raised in Detroit, he regards himself above all as a black man, as a black American. In fact, his identity is much more, he says, Detroit than it is even American. And it was just striking to me that this is, I think, says something about, I think, increasingly the United States of America, that people in the U.S., as time goes on, more and more think of themselves as their main identity is not really American. It's something, some subset of that. They're black American or Hispanic American, or they're Christian, or they're something else. And that's different than the identity, I think, that most countries have. They have a settled and rooted identity, a national identity that increasingly is, insofar as it ever existed, but increasingly is less the case in America. And that was personified, you might say, in the selection or the group of Americans that happened to be involved in this film festival and conference.
But in contrast to Iran, besides their religion, they also have a strong sort of national or even ethnic identity.
Oh, yes. Iranians have a very proud heritage that goes back for thousands of years. They are proud of their heritage as the Persian Empire, cultural achievements of their people over many, many centuries. And there's a great reverence, you might say, or at least a great regard for the cultural heritage of the people. For example, I was very struck by the way in which how much regard there is for poetry among Iranians. Now, this isn't just my observation. You can read about this and learn about this from others. In fact, in the final session of the festival conclusion, there was not only a recitation of the Quran, which is typical of all meetings. All meetings take place and begin with a recitation of the Quran, and very often with the playing of the national anthem, but also was a reading from the poetry of the Iranian poet Hafiz, who died many centuries ago. But this heritage is very important. And in fact, there's a Shia Muslim identity, but even stronger, I would say, an identity as Iranians. And this is very, very important. In fact, it's a very powerful combination to have both a national identity fortified or strengthened with a strong religious identity, and that gives Iran some of the strength of its society that it has.
Well, when you talk about America, I think there's this sort of debate about white identity, of whites being the majority versus a greater American identity. Do you have that discussion in Iran where you have different minority groups like the Kurds and the Baluchi, and they have the dominant, about, I think Persians are maybe about half of the country's population. Is there that debate about whether they're at their ethnic identity as Persians or sort of a greater national identity that includes all ethnic groups?
Right. There are different estimates of the percentage of the population that is Iranian. It's estimated to be 50-60% Iranian. But the minorities, which include Azeris, Arabs, Baluchis, they tend to be on the border area, not in Tehran. Now, in Tehran, there are some minorities, but the minority populations are on the border. And what the government hopes and tries to cultivate is a unity that's based not just on ethnicity, but also based on a shared Muslim identity as well. And so, yeah, that's true. There is a very large percentage of the population of Iran is not ethnically Iranian, but the core is, and that's very important identity for the people. And of course, Farsi, the Iranian language, is the only official language of the country.
So you got to meet with Ahmadinejad. How did that meeting come about?
A number of us most of the people who were involved and participants in the festival and conference were invited with an audience with the president. And so everybody went to the presidential center. It's not a palace exactly, but the presidential center. And of course, there was a lot of security, as one might expect, just as there would be if one came to the White House or the U.S. Congress. But in addition to that, a few of us were asked also to address the meeting. Ahmadinejad spoke at the meeting, but I and Marilyn Miller and a Frenchman and a Palestinian were also asked to address the meeting. Of course, at this meeting and at many other meetings, everything is translated simultaneously into, translations are, the languages are Farsi, English, French, and Arabic. Everything was available in all those languages. But the talk that I gave was a very brief one. I only spoke for maybe 5 minutes or so. It's a very short thing. And none of those who were asked to or invited to speak really spoke for very long. But we did listen to a talk by Ahmadinejad himself, and we also briefly met him and shook hands with him. But Ahmadinejad's speech, I was told by people afterwards that what he said is the same. He makes the same point over and over. In fact, the points he made in his speech and the tone of his speech was very similar to the tone and the remarks he made at a speech at the United Nations last week. He tends to stress some of the same things over and over and over again. It's one of the reasons why I think that he probably really believes what he says, because he keeps coming back to these same themes. One of them that's interesting, if you paid attention, or anybody paid attention to his United Nations speech, is how he says and emphasizes his belief, expresses his view that the hidden Imam, Mahdi, and Jesus will soon come to earth, or will be coming to earth, and how it's important to act in such a way and to carry out our lives in such a way as to be worthy of the reappearance of the Imam and of Jesus. It's important to remember that for Muslims, Jesus is a prophet. He's revered in Islam. And it was interesting to me that a statesman, a head of a country, even in a forum like the United Nations, should be expressing his view and hope that Jesus and the hidden Imam of which is a Shia Muslim view, will be coming back to coming to Earth and ushering in a new era.
So does Jesus play a more important role in Shia Islam than with Sunnis?
I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I don't think it's any more or less important. There are some important differences between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam. I wish I knew more about that. But one of the important points is that Shia Islam is very particularly identified with Iran. Iran is the one really staunchly Shia Muslim country that there is, and that's that aspect of Islam gives is an important part of the identity of the regime and of the country, of the people.
So did you really get a chance to talk to Ahmadinejad?
No, only a few words, just a very little, no. I mean, one-to-one, we just said a few sentences.
Because I know Marilyn Miller said that he had a fairly lengthy conversation.
Right, that was in a different context. He was there for the same at the time I was, but in addition, he met with President Ahmadinejad on another occasion. So I didn't have the same ability or opportunity to speak with Ahmadinejad in the same way that Marilyn Miller did.
And you also gave a speech at a university.
Well, I gave a talk to a large meeting of some 800 students. It was not at the university. It was near the university at a large hall. The university was actually on break right now, and so it was all the more impressive to me that hundreds of students would come to hear a lecture by me, even though it wasn't even part of their class or even at a time when the school was in session. I was only told what the topic would be the same day, but the topic was one I was prepared to speak about. It was on the Zionist lobby in America. And of course, I talked about this subject quite a bit, and I had brought some notes and paper anyway, so I was prepared to talk about that. But the talk went on for a bit more than 2 hours, and as I spoke, my remarks were translated into Farsi. But I was very impressed with the patience and the interest and the perceptiveness of many of the questions that were asked as well during this. It was also in a very hot hall. It was a very hot day. The hallway was a large one, but it was not air conditioned. And everybody was very hot. A lot of people were fanning themselves. I was sweating. And I was all the more impressed by how patiently people followed what I said and paid attention to and stayed for the entire event.
What are some of the questions that you were asked?
There was an interesting question about the role of Christian evangelical Christians in America who support Zionism and why. Why do so many Christians support Israel? That was an important question, I think, because it's a uniquely American phenomenon. There's nothing like that in other countries. That is, a large Christian population or a large number of people identify themselves as Christian who also have this very strong support for Israel, and I tried to deal with that question. Another question, which really got to the core of things, is how is it possible for Americans to support policies which are pretty obviously against the interests of their own country and their own interests? How is that possible in the United States? And that goes to really the nature of American society and American politics. And I dealt with that question at some length too. I don't remember any of the other questions, but I was.
Were those policies? Were there specific examples brought up of those policies?
Oh yeah. Well, by me, yeah. I brought up. I mean, in answer to the question, and during my talk, I gave many examples. I mean, one of the points I made very strongly, and at some length, was that in 1948, when Israel was founded as a country, when it declared itself a state, this was during the administration of President Truman, the Secretary of State of the United States, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, the head of the Middle East section of the State Department, and the policy section of the State Department all urged President Truman not even to recognize Israel. They all warned at that time that U.S. support for Zionism in Palestine would be not only a betrayal of American principles that they claim to uphold, but would also get the United States involved in endless disputes and squabbles against the interests of the United States and the American people, much less, of course, the interests of the world. Now, this point has been made over and over again, and I stress that Truman made the decision to recognize Israel in 1948 against the advice of his own high officials because he put domestic political considerations above the interests of America. And this point was already made in 1948, and this has been the pattern ever since. I also cited a memorandum in 1969 by Henry Kissinger to Nixon, talking about the danger of Israel having a nuclear arsenal, and how this is bad for the world and bad for America, but that, and in fact, Kissinger wrote in the memo that the technology for Israel's nuclear arsenal was probably stolen from the United States, and that Israel had broken its word, broken its pledges in developing nuclear weapons. But Kissinger said that the domestic political price of revealing this and exposing this and countering it would be too heavy. That is, the domestic political considerations for Nixon and the Republican Party would be so great that America had to subordinate its national interest to domestic political interests. Now, those are some examples, and I could give many, many others, of how America's alliance with Israel has been palpably harmful to America's interests, and of course the interests, I think, of justice and of the world. And we're seeing now this come to a new head with the threats that Israel is making against Iran, because it might be building a nuclear reactor. The idea that a country can attack another country, as Israel is threatening to do so, because they might be building, might have the new capability of building a nuclear weapon, is an extremely dangerous precedent, a very dangerous one. And for America to give any credence or support to that is harmful not only, obviously, to America's interests, but to world peace and the interests of humanity.
I want to get into that a little bit with the – well, we can talk about the situation at the U.N. You brought up the Ahmadinejad speech, but what happened when Netanyahu spoke. But before I get to that, I mean, what is your conclusion, and what did you get out of this trip?
Well, I got a much better sense of what the feeling and the mood is in Iran. I learned much more about the society. I talked also with a number, I mean, not with Ahmadinejad, but I did talk with a number of officials, and I got a sense from them of what the kind of official view on a lot of these questions is as well. The visit overwhelmingly reinforced in my mind what I think the whole world believes. That is, a military strike against Iran would be catastrophic, it would be terrible, it would be bad and harmful to everyone. And the point I make over and over is that the U.S. alliance with Israel is a reflection, an expression of the grip that the organized Jewish community has on America's political life and cultural life, and that this power, what I call Jewish Zionist power, is harmful not only, of course, in its threat to Iran, in its oppression of Palestinians, in the turmoil of the Middle East, but also is a very powerful one for America, and that there is a common interest of all people to oppose this power, which has an agenda and an outlook and values very different from those of the, and interests very different than those of the vast majority of people in the world.
So you know about what happened when Netanyahu, he recently spoke at the UN, and he did that thing with the, where he put up that, was it a picture of a nuclear bomb?
The cartoon, basically.
Yeah, a cartoon.
Yeah, I mean, it was silly, really. Silly, unbelievably silly. I mean, it shows the level at which he's trying to communicate people on the level of a cartoon.
I guess he's trying to imply that the people listening to him are stupid.
Well, I don't know if he means to imply, but it certainly does imply that, yeah. It's childish and dangerous, really. I mean, he says things and makes threats that are really outrageous. I mean, the Americans should be insulted by this, because, as I have made the point many times, when Netanyahu last appeared at the U.S. Congress, he got 29 or 30 standing ovations. This is more ovations, standing ovations, than any American president would get, and more than Netanyahu would get from his own parliament. This is a reflection not of the intelligence or the perspicacity and the wisdom of the American Congress, but the extent to which the American Congress is corrupt and beholden to this power. That's a very sorry, sad, shameful situation in our country. And Netanyahu can say these things because he knows and is able to take advantage of the grip that this Jewish Zionist hold has on our country. And this is reflected, I mean, there's a world consensus, really, about how the Middle East situation should be solved, how the Israel-Palestine issue should be dealt with. This is reflected in overwhelming votes in the United Nations. There's a world consensus, understanding about this. It's only in the United States and in Israel where you have this bizarre alternative universe kind of view of these issues.
Well, Mark, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's a pleasure being on with you again. Thank you.
And your website for the IHR, it's IHR.org.
IHR.org, yes, and there's a lot, of course, because we deal a lot with international tension about wars, conflict, and the origins of war and conflict. Right now, of course, there's a great deal about the Iran-Israel situation, because that's one of the great questions the world is trying to grapple with right now.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.